You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 539. It's not only dialogue, it's also mood, situation, the missed scene. It's one of the reasons I can direct my material better than anyone else, because I have the confidence in my material that no one else would. Quentin Tarantino.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T chart.
Well, guys, today on the show, we have a interesting filmmaking story. On the show, we have filmmaker Saviv Freeman. And Saviv reached out to me telling me a story of, you know, what he went through to get his first feature film made, which is about $10,000 feature film, which I found interesting. And also that he went through a lot of uphill battles, just things that most filmmakers don't have to go through. And I'll let him kind of tell you about that in the conversation. But he also was able to land an amazing, legendary producer by the name of Carrie Woods, who was also on the show a few episodes ago. And how he was able to land, you know, the producer of Swingers, Scream, Godzilla for a $10,000 movie was really interesting to me. So this is a pretty inspirational story. So get ready to be inspired. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Saviv Freeman.
I'd like to welcome the show, Saviv Freeman. How you doing, Saviv?
I'm doing good. How are you, Alex?
I'm doing good, brother. I'm doing good, man. Thank you for coming on the show. Like we were talking about earlier before we got on the air, is I get hit up almost 20, 30 times a day now, without question, by filmmakers wanting to be on the show. And I try to make as much room as I can. But at a certain point, we can't hear the same story again and again and again. You know, like, you know, oh, I've made my movie for $5,000. That's great. And if it was 1991, I'd probably have you on the show much faster. But your story actually kind of has a few unique elements to it. So we're going to get into that as well. But can you tell the audience a little bit? Because we were talking earlier, you found me. You've been listening to me for a little while. So how did you find me, and how have I been able to even help you on your path?
Yeah, sure. So basically, you know, when I decided to get into filmmaking, I knew right away I wasn't going to do the college route, the film school route, for various reasons. So, you know, YouTube to me was sort of the, you know, wealth of information. Everything is on YouTube nowadays. And, you know, so I'd listen to various channels, and one of them was Indie Film Hustle. I mean, I have a lot of friends who listen to you and know your channel. It's, you know, pretty popular among us, what we call the underground filmmakers. So we just listened to it. And I also saw your evolution, which is pretty wild. You know, like I remember you were talking to, you know, sort of like mid-level producers and directors. And now you're talking to Oliver Stone. And, you know, it's pretty crazy. And congratulations to that.
I've been very humbled and blessed to be speaking to the people I've been speaking to lately, and it's been humbling to say the least, man. And I'm glad, and a lot of my audience have told me that they're like, man, I've seen you when I was there at the beginning, when you were just talking to like you know just young filmmakers, and now you're talking to legends and things, and it's been very. Look, man, if I can get any information out of those guys and gals and bring it to the underground filmmaker, to an independent filmmaker who didn't have the opportunity to sit down for an hour to talk to Oliver Stone, I want to be able to do that. So, but thanks, man. I'm glad I've been of service to you on your journey. And, I always find it fascinating how people find me and how it, cause I don't get to talk to people often, listeners, I generally only see them at a film festival every once in a while. So how did you get started in the business, man? What made you want to jump into this ridiculous business?
It's a good question. I don't know if I made the right choice. No, I'm kidding. But it wasn't really like that. It wasn't really so much of a business. And like most of us, it was, I was just obsessed with movies from a very young age. I didn't really know that somebody made movies. You don't realize that there's like somebody's orchestrating the story. I wanted to be an actor, to tell the truth, way back. I wanted to be in the movies. That's all I wanted, from a pretty young age. And then, I'm not sure exactly when I realized that there was a director. I think it might have been a, mini doc about the making of Lord of the Rings. And I remember seeing Peter Jackson, it was like 2 a.m. or something. It might have been The Hobbit, I'm not sure. Anyways, and he's driving to like pick up the DP or something. And just like the whole vibe and the whole, they're all joking around. I think that might have been, when I started to realize that there was this one guy, this puppeteer basically. And then I just became obsessed with the concept of the director,
I remember in the Lord of the Rings docs, this is when the first Lord of the Rings came out, that he released that insane DVD set that just had like 7 hours or 10 hours of like how they made it on each movie. And the one thing I always never forgot is that he had his crew carry around a Lazy Boy, and that was his director's chair. Like a recliner, like a full, not like a director's chair. He like had a full recliner, and they would just carry it around from set to set, and he would sit there and he'd do everything, and then he'd get up. I was like, why hasn't that become a thing? I have no idea.
Sounds like Peter Jackson though,
Well, if you're Peter Jackson and you've already released the first Lord of the Rings, I think you can get away with that kind of stuff. Yeah. By the way, everyone listening, if you're an independent filmmaker, do not bring a recliner on set and say it's your director's chair. People will hate you.
for sure, yeah.
Go ahead.
No, just about the director's chair. I remember, my first few short films, I never sat down. I just stand the whole time, adrenaline rush. I remember seeing Roger Corman, some interview of his not too long ago. He must, I'm pretty sure he's still alive, right?
He's still alive, in the 90s.
And he was saying how, they ask him like director's advice, and you think he's going to talk about lenses and whatever it might be. And he says, just make sure to have a chair to sit down in. That was his that was his advice.
I spoke to a Steadicam, I think the inventor of the Steadicam, and he goes, what's the best piece of advice for anybody who wants to learn the Steadicam? And he's like, good shoes. Comfortable shoes is the biggest best of advice. Now, tell me a little bit about your background before you jumped into filmmaking, because from what you told me in your email, filmmaking is not really looked nice, very positively by your family. So what are the struggles you had to deal with that?
Yeah, so, I'll speak vaguely a little bit because I don't want to get in too much trouble, but
sure.
But basically, I come from a religious community, or ultra-Orthodox community, Jewish community. And I think like a lot of very far-right religious communities, when I say far-right, I don't mean politically far-right, I mean religiously very conservative. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. they have a weird relationship with movies in general and with Hollywood, the business, just the concept of Hollywood. Hollywood is sort of the boogeyman for a lot of people in my community. And I think a lot of it has to do with, Hollywood sort of was the front runner of the, counterculture revolution. And I think a lot of it started there, the way Hollywood, the sexuality in Hollywood movies, particularly from the 60s and on, Rebel Without a Cause, all these movies, were seen as a threat to religious communities and to my community. So that's part of it. Part of it is like, so Hollywood is this big scary thing and there's a lot of immorality there and things like that. I think that's really what it is. So in my family, it really was the same thing. Modern movies, I wasn't able to see Star Wars or Pirates of the Caribbean, stuff that's, pretty much tailored for kids, even that, because there's a fear that it has traces of, either ideologies that disagree with the religion, postmodern ideas and things like that, or, explicit scenes and, stuff like that. So, so that's basically where I come from.
So, all right. So then you see a little film called Star Wars. What happens after you see Star Wars? By the way, you're not the only one who saw Star Wars and like James Cameron did that too. So you're in good company that Star Wars changed your life.
I hope that was unique, but I guess no,
not so much.
So I had a neighbor who was, also religious, but more modern than me. His parents were more chilled, so they let him see a lot of stuff, and he would just rant and rave about Star Wars, and I didn't know anything about it, but I just knew I had to see this thing. He had the toy lightsaber, he had video games. So I just looked it up one day on my dad's computer, and I saw A New Hope in like parts. I'm pretty sure at one time, if not the whole thing or part of it, was just on YouTube. This is, 15 years ago, whatever it is. So I saw the first Star Wars and I think, I always had, my mom would read us, like science fiction and books. So it's not that I knew about these worlds, but only in my head.
Sure.
And then when I saw Star Wars, it was the first time I actually saw it on a screen that in movies, people are able to do this. They're able to, create these crazy fantasies and these worlds. And it was as simple as that. It just, it was like the Big Bang for me, it was, and I just became obsessed with Star Wars and playing Star Wars with my brothers and having lightsaber fights and stuff. And
right.
So, I think the Star Wars obsession really was like the sort
catalyst.
Of the thing, the bug that bit me,
Yeah. As I like to call it, the beautiful disease. Or the beautiful infection that is filmmaking, because once you get it, you can't get rid of it. No matter how hard you try, or no matter what obstacles happens to be in your way, it's something you just have to do. So, which brings me to your first movie, Man. How did you, living in the environment that you were living in, not getting much support, I'm assuming, from your family or community, how did you generate not only the energy to make it, but to find the money for it and all that whole thing. So how did that whole process come along?
I didn't maintain the energy, as you can maybe see.
you look as old as I am. No, I'm joking.
It's trying to get the timeline right. So basically I went to Israel, actually. I went to study in Israel, on the hopes of becoming like a big rabbi or whatever. It was a very intense thing. It was a good experience, but it just didn't work out for me. I had a lot of good friends who went there to study. But I was a movie addict, a movie junkie. Like that's how I got through high school. Like, there was a time where I was dorming in a very serious religious school where, if they would catch you with watching a movie, you were thrown out. And we would just watch movies under our covers. Literally, I remember seeing Schindler's List in my dorm room on a tiny phone, for the first time.
I'm sure Steven would exactly how he wanted you to watch it.
Exactly. So basically when I came back, I got a job as an assistant teacher in a school. But it was just a soul crushing job. And I just had this, you know, like buzz in my ear, like this little whisper in my ear. And then eventually, and then I had a friend who passed away, sadly. And right before he passed away, I was talking to him about, I want to be a director, you know, and he came from the similar, we grew up together, went to school together. But at the time he became more open-minded and everything. And we saw Goodfellas, we saw like all the classics together. I saw Goodfellas in his grandmother's basement, you know? So, you know, he was very positive about it. And he said, you know, I think you should do this. And then he literally died a week later.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. He was an incredible guy. He would do De Niro impressions and all this. So that really compelled me, I think. Like, I remember being at his funeral and at his burial, and I just felt really angry. And I just decided, like, I'm just going to try to do this, you know? So I basically, you know, I had this idea for a short film. Turns out the short film was going to cost like $100,000 to make. You know, that's how it goes. When you first start, you write a script. It was like a mixture of Blade Runner and all these different things. And I remember, like, I went online, I was looking for a producer, and I found some girl on Upwork. I don't remember, one of these things, one of the, you know, the film sites. And she said, yeah, well, I'll produce it, you know. So I meet with her. She said, oh, first we have to make a trailer, you know, like a sizzle reel or whatever, to raise money through Indiegogo. So basically, I ended up getting $2,000 from this. I used to work with special needs children. So there was a kid I was taking care of, and his dad was like a big fan of this movie obsession of mine. So he gave me like $2,000 cash on the spot for the trailer.
That's amazing.
So we made this trailer, it was an utter disaster. I mean, it just didn't work out. And we raised like $100. It was like my older brother who gave the money, you know, like on Indiegogo. It was pretty embarrassing. So then, you know, it was like back to square one again. I'm like, how in the world is this going to happen? It just was, you know, the trailer was pretty good, I think, but it just didn't fly. It just didn't work out. And then I remember I was watching Vice News did a thing on Christopher Nolan's Following. They interviewed him about zero budget filmmaking. And I was watching his advice, and he basically said, just take a camera, you know, the thing that they say. But to me, the thing about him, certain filmmakers you could see, like you could tell they sort of come from the underground world, but here's the guy who made Inception and all these things. And then I saw Following, and it's this real, you know, gritty. Run and go.
Yeah,
like glued together, you know, with popsicle sticks or whatever. It's a brilliant film, brilliant. But it's unbelievable to see that he went from there to there. So I basically heeded his advice. I took a camera. I shot a short film. You know, I the only money was to the camera and stuff and to the makeup artist. And that film was okay. You know, like I put it out there. Some people liked it. Some people didn't. But that's basically how it starts. Just kept making short films. And then I produced a short film for this thing called the Indie Film Collective. That was an interesting experience. And then we made another short film. And then just over time, making all these short films, I picked up a very small following on the internet. I mean, when I say small, I'm talking about like maybe 10, 15 people, whatever it is. But it was enough that at a certain point, I just decided it's time to make a feature film. And I kept trying to make feature films or like trying to get it off the ground, but it just never worked, you know. And my older brother, he's a pretty well-to-do, successful business guy. He's completely self-made. And he just said, you don't be embarrassed. You just have to ask people, you know. And again, you know, where I'm from, people don't really know what that – like there's no such thing as somebody going to make movies. It's bizarre, you know.
I know the feeling.
Yeah. It's what the other people do, you know. Like it's not a real profession that could ever happen. So I think I was at my friend's engagement party. Ultra Orthodox engagement party. And I just summed up the courage and I just started asking people up front. I said, you know, could I have money for my movie? And they're like, your movie? What? You know, and I had to like quickly explain while I was like trembling. Yeah, I'm making a movie, you know, and Christopher Nolan, I could just try to explain to them. And a lot of the guys there, they're just very kind people, very generous. They just said, whatever, let the kid go do his high school play or whatever they were thinking, you know?
Yeah.
I raised like $800 to $1,000 literally that day just from asking people, you know, just basically bullying people into giving me money. And then with that seed money, I joined forces with a friend of mine and we basically started raising money online, crowdfunding on Indiegogo. And we raised like $8,000 that way. And I put in another $1,000 of my own. And we basically managed to get the budget together. But there was no, it wasn't easy.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
So then when you get the movie done, then you're now, and you basically got it in the can, but from what you told me, you basically were kind of kicked out of your house and you were like sleeping on the floor or on a couch with your sister. You know, we all have struggles as filmmakers, man. Like, there's no question. As you're trying to get your feature made, we all got to beg. We get to beg and, you know, sometimes steal. do whatever you got to do to get the movie done.
Yeah. Rob a bank, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the insanity of being a filmmaker. But you have the extra stress of also not having a place to live at this point and all that stuff. How did you break through that, man? How did you break? Because I've never experienced that. I was just curious.
Yeah. So also throughout the shooting, we shot once a week. So I was shooting once a week. And when I'm shooting, I feel like, you know, you're on top of the world when you're shooting.
Oh, yeah. It's the drug. It's a drug. Absolutely.
It's a drug. You're high, you know. And then I would come home and, you know, my siblings are amazing. You know, my brothers, they're very supportive and stuff, you know. But I don't blame nobody, you know. Like, how are they supposed to know what the hell I'm doing? And it's not just a religious thing. A lot of parents aren't, you know.
Oh, no. Regardless.
Anything in the arts is insane. So I would come home. I'd come back here and they'd be like, you know, you're kind of like a rock star when you're directing. And then you come home and it's like, you know, it's like coming back to the slums. You know, it's like a descent. So it was really depressing in a way. It was like swinging between these different worlds. And then, so the shooting itself there was a lot of stress in not just the production, but just this dichotomy or duality that I was dealing with, going from basically sinning, you know, doing the grave sin of, you know, making movies, which is this, again, like sort of like taboo satanic thing. And then coming home and, you know, whatever, participating in the Sabbath and all this stuff. And then we finished, we wrapped shooting. It wasn't the most satisfying production. You know, again, it's the first feature film.
Sure.
Made for a penny. And then I come home and, you know, I don't want to tell you too much, but basically it's a combination of, you know, I didn't have a proper income. You know, I wasn't making money, didn't have a real, you know, my parents were very worried about me. You know, I didn't have a career path. Sure. Then again, it's the movies, it's all these things coupled together. And I basically just pissed off enough people and they were like, you know, sparks flew and I basically was told nicely to leave. And I went to my older sister, you know, who was living in Queens, and I was just sleeping in her husband's study on a mattress on the floor. It wasn't that bad though. They were pretty good to me, you know. But I was really desperate to get a job. You know, it was kind of like the wake up call. I was like, all right, this movie dream probably is not going to work. You know, I made this movie, wasn't edited at all. We didn't cut it.
It's just a bunch of hard drives at this point.
It was just hard drives just sitting there. My editor, Christian, who works for Complex Media, who I met, a whole different story, but he edited all my shorts basically. He put together a trailer for me and a reel because I called him like frantically saying I'm doomed. And he's always been like, he's my right hand man, you know, like if not for him, I wouldn't be anywhere. So he was really supportive. He's like, I'll make you a reel. Don't worry about it. So he made me a reel, made me a trailer, and I put it into our resume. And I just started applying to film jobs because I didn't want to go back to being an assistant teacher or whatever it might be. And I went on Mandy, my older brother. I was so broke. I didn't have like a dollar, you know, filmmaker. So my older brother, he paid for my Mandy subscription, you know, for like a month. And I'm just applying to like everything in the world, you know, PA, AD, and horror movie, ultra low budget horror movie and all this stuff. And I applied to maybe 30, 40 things or whatever it might have been. And then I applied to a director gig, like a horror movie director gig. And of course, you know, that would have been great, you know. And then like a week later, I get a call from some guy, the producer of this horror movie. And he's like, is this Tzvi Friedman? I'm like, yeah. And he says, you know, I saw your resume or whatever. Why don't you come down and let's have a chat, whatever. Let's get lunch, whatever it was. And I was like, oh yeah, I'm gonna get the job. You know, I'm so desperate at this point. And I remember it was snowing, freezing cold. I go out there, and like the second I meet the guy, he's like, you know, I don't think you're the right fit for the job. And I'm like, oh great, another one of these, you know, immediate waste of time. And then he says, but I saw the trailer for your feature. I saw some of your shorts and I really like it. And I sent your work to my friend, Carrie Woods. I have no idea who that is. But again, this guy, you know, he thinks, he assumes I know, you know, like he doesn't realize, like, you know, where I'm coming from, you know, that I've no, you know, connection with the business whatsoever. And he's like, he really wants to meet you. So when I leave the meeting, I call up my editor, Christian, and I say, oh my God, this guy, he said, Carrie Woods, this whole thing. Because I Googled Carrie Woods right after and I saw his credits.
He's a legend. He's a legend.
Yeah. And Christian, my editor, again, I love him. This isn't to disparage him, but he just was like, ah, come on, man. You know, because, you know, people, he's been in the business much longer than me and he's in a much more professional sphere and he's had horror stories. So he was like, you know, I wouldn't, just don't get your hopes up.
Yeah, right. I would say the exact same thing if you were talking to me.
Yeah. And like, I waited for like a week. I was like, should I call back this guy and ask him? And like, I was waiting with my phone there, like, you know, and then I get a call from this producer again. And he said, why don't you come over Friday evening for dinner with Carrie? He'll be there, you know? So I go there, I go to this like penthouse again, like, you know, I didn't grow up poor or anything, but, you know, just regular middle class,
sure,
know, religious,
sure,
family, five siblings, and, you know, everybody's like lives very simply where I come from. And all of a sudden I'm in this, you know, crazy apartment and there's Carrie and he looks like right out of his Wikipedia page, you know, it's a little weird. I was like, we didn't really talk much, you know, I didn't try to sell myself or anything. But it was weird to be in a place where like everybody was filmmakers on a slightly high, you know, on a much higher level than me, all in the business, and who appreciated my work, which was really surreal for me.
That's a cool experience. That's a cool feeling.
Yeah, it was also like another type of high, you know, like I was used to always feeling guilty about my work. And, you know, mm-hmm. I at one time I would show it to my work to my parents, but they just didn't understand it. They thought it was bizarre. You know, and, you know, my dad would watch my dad has a good taste in movies, but it was more very conventional, very formulaic classics. And here I'm trying to make like a Buñuel weird experimental.
Truffaut, right?
Yeah. And he's like, you know, what's with the hands or whatever, you know? So I just used to getting that. Or even my religious friends who love movies, but like they want to watch like Michael Mann's Heat or something. They're not, you know, watching sure. these bizarro French movies. So basically, so that was a really great feeling. And then a few days later, Carrie texted me, said, hey, let's get coffee or something. And we got coffee and, you know, we just talked movies and he has all kinds of crazy Hollywood stories, you know, Robert De Niro. So, and Robert De Niro is my favorite actor. So we spoke about that. He worked with Werner Herzog on, Julie Funky Boy, just endless stories. And he also was an agent before he was a producer, you know, so. He has all kinds of stories about that. And then what I don't remember exactly the timeline. I don't want to distort the facts. But more or less, he basically called me up one day and he said, hey, I'll help you. I'm going to try to help you finish your feature film. I'll see if I could get some investors and whatever. You can imagine I was like in seventh heaven. And then we got investors. He got me a lawyer. And then he actually connected me with this unbelievable film producer, Jonathan Gray, who's an indie film producer who also did a bunch of pretty mm-hmm. big films, Flannel Pajamas and Blue Caprice and you name it. He did a lot of very critically acclaimed films, Dark Knight, not The Dark Knight, Dark Knight, which went to Sundance a couple years ago. And he basically became a producing partner with Carrie on this film. And he gave us an office at his studio, Gigantic Studios. Which was insane. We just were cutting there for like 3 months. We just were squatting there. Me and Christian and I, my editor, we just were cutting there. And I was able to pay Christian finally. You know, I never paid him in my life. I was able to pay him a few dollars. You know, that was nice. And that's sort of the story in a nutshell. I don't know. I'm just
wow, man. That's a pretty remarkable story. Yeah, because that was the twist that also added another layer to this onion that is your story, is because, like, you know, trying to get your movie made, all this kind of stuff, but then all of a sudden getting a major producer like Carrie Woods on board, who's a legend. He's an indie film legend. I mean, from Swingers to Kids and so many other movies he's made over the years. You know, to get him on board with essentially a first-time filmmaker, I was fascinated. I'm like, how the hell did this happen? I always love these little stories of how people connect and how things fall apart, fall into place. And it's just luck being at the right place, right time. Like, and I want people listening to understand this, is that there is no path that you can copy. You know, I wasted a good decade trying to figure out how to copy Kevin Smith's path or Robert Rodriguez's path or Ed Burns' path. Like these guys, you can't copy their path because their paths are unique to them for the time frame when that happens. So you place an ad, go for an interview. They happen to watch your short. Hey, I have a friend of mine. Like there's so many things that were magical.
Insane. Yeah, it's insane.
It's luck. It's luck. But if you didn't have all those shorts, if you didn't have a trailer, if you hadn't had a movie ready in the can, nobody would have, this wouldn't have happened. So it is truly when luck meets preparation. And that's exactly your story. It's a pretty magical story. So now where are you with the movie? Are you still finishing it up in post? Are you getting ready to put it out to the festivals?
So we already submitted to a bunch of festivals, but it's still a quote unquote work in progress. We're doing the music now. That's where we're at now. So we're picture locked, we're doing the music, literally, like we just started yesterday. And also the color, which we're basically finished. And we're just trying, nowadays you have, it's not like it used to be. Now you have literally tens of thousands of films, you know, everybody with their $100,000 movie. There's just a lot of competition. It's very easy to get lost in the pile. It's sort of playing a lottery, you know, at the end of the day.
Yeah, it's pretty, if you've listened to the show and you've seen the show, you know, I've talked about distribution and how to get your movie out there and stuff. It is very difficult to get an independent film you have no stars, if I'm not mistaken. You have no faces or stars in the movie at all.
We have some future stars. I'm not just saying that to be nice. We particularly, the main actor in our movie, at one time he was on the Broadway show Cabaret, Sam Mendes's production. But he's a brilliant actor, brilliant. His name's John Peterson. Shout out to John. But he's really remarkable. You know, like even all these producers that we've been showing the movie to now, like we're showing it to all these guys we've been doing forever, and they're all like, wow, you know.
So the thing is.
Yeah.
So, but as far as distribution is concerned,
of course.
Yeah. You know, if I walk into a distributor's room and like, hey, I got a lot of future stars, they're going to be like, get the hell out of here. Not lack of talent, but lack of star power, meaning recognizable faces.
Yeah. Right.
So without that, it is difficult to do it unless you happen to get into a film festival that could be, you know, that likes it and it gets some awards and then maybe gets some attention. But, you know, just as a since you haven't asked me for this advice, but this is what I would do. I would use Kerry Woods' name as much as he allows you to use it to open doors for you, because that name does carry a lot of weight in the indie film space. And if they're like, wait a minute, if Kerry's executive producing this guy's film, I should maybe watch it because of his track record. So you've got an ace in the hole without question. It's not going to help you. It might help you a little bit in distribution, but it will definitely help you in the film festival circuit without question.
It is. I don't know what I'm allowed to say, but like,
I don't want you to get in trouble. Don't get in trouble.
Exactly. I don't either want to get in trouble, but no, definitely Carrie. But not just Carrie. We have a lot of Carrie sort of built an army around the film.
Right. It's amazing that a producer of his magnitude, who's done so many films over the years, still is hunting for that, you know, that diamond in the rough. Just trying to grab something and trying to help a filmmaker along. And that's another part of the story that I love, is that someone like him is not too high up in the mountain where all the gods, the filmmaking gods live. Like Mount Olympus, you know, where Spielberg and Lucas and all those guys live, that he's still willing to do, because he doesn't have to. I mean, he completely doesn't have to do anything, but he wants to because he loves the process so much and wants to help young voices come out. So that's a really pretty awesome part of the story. So I'll got to get Kerry on the show one day. I want to talk to Kerry.
I think he'd do it. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's just a really, I mean, You know, I don't know why he decided to do this. You'll have to ask him.
But. Right. You're like, I don't know why I'm here. I don't know how this happened.
It's kind of like, you know, the movie Being There, which is actually one of Carrie's favorite movies.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I love Being
Peter
There.
Peter Sellers. Yeah. He's just like this, you know, I think he's supposed to be on the spectrum, if I'm not mistaken. And he's just like stumbling into, you know, power, you know, into powerful people and into all these rooms. And you're just like, oh, what am I doing here? And I get that all the time, you know, like, I'll be at once you meet these people, all of a sudden you're at these events and all of a sudden you're meeting these people who, some of these people inspired you to like do this thing, you know, and you're just, it's bizarre and you're not sure. And they ask you like, who are you? And you're like, I'm not sure who I am, but, you know,
security.
But Carrie's a really righteous guy. I think he's a really, he's just a really good person, you know, above all else. He's like a real cinephile. He really loves cinema. Yeah. You know, even though he might have produced some really big commercial movies too, but he just loves cinema, and I think he just really wants to try. You know, he sees himself sort of maybe again. I shouldn't. You know, you'll have to ask him. But my read is that he really feels like a guardian of cinema. And that's why I got lucky. You know, I bumped into him, but. You know, but yeah, that's why he hasn't just done this for me. I'm not the only person, but pretty much many of the directors he's worked with were all first time directors, you know, and,
Doug Liman with Swingers and John Favreau and that whole crew. I mean, helping exactly. them along and the list goes on and on. I mean, he's helped so many filmmakers over
James
the course
Mangold
of his
career. And, M. Night Shyamalan.
A couple guys.
Like second, like legit movie. Like M. Night did like a low budget indie that went to a bunch of festivals, but his second, you know, like more studio film or whatever, Carrie made that happen. And yeah, the list goes on forever. But you know, yeah, so it's really cool. And also another cool thing is that Carrie's producing a film called Maggie Moore's, which is a John Hamm movie right now, you know, in New Mexico. So it's just funny how we're making our little $10,000 movie and stuff, and Carrie's sending us notes, and then he's, you know, busy with these guys. It's really weird.
I also wanted to have you on the show because I want filmmakers out there listening to see that this does happen still. These kind of little, this is a lottery ticket moment. These are kind of lottery ticket moments. I mean, look, you're not making the next Marvel movie yet or anything like that, but you are definitely on a path that will hopefully build a career for yourself. And having a champion help you. And we everyone needs a champion, from Spielberg to, you know, every one of the gods, the filmmaking gods that we look up to had a champion. If it wasn't for Steven Soderbergh, Nolan wouldn't have gotten Insomnia. And without Insomnia, he wouldn't have gotten Batman, and the rest that goes on and on. Sure. There's always a champion. So I'm just glad that we could put this kind of story out there for filmmakers to hopefully hold on to and go, look, there is a hope. The thing is that you just have to do the work without expectation, because that's exactly what you did. You didn't have any expectation of anything happening to you other than hopefully this is going to get made and hopefully I'll be able to do another one, let alone – right. Teaming up with the producer of Carrie and becoming homeless as well. Let me ask you. I want to ask you, man. What is when you were on set? I always like to ask this question.
Sure.
When you were on set shooting one day a week, which is fascinating, which is awesome.
100 weeks, yeah.
It was awesome. What was the toughest day on set? Like that day that you felt everything was going to come crashing down around you, and how did you overcome it?
That's almost every day, but we had many days. We just have crazy, crazy stories. I mean, again, not anything new, but fun, you know? So we were operating with a tiny crew. First of all, like some of our crew pulled out, you know,
Shocking,
exactly. So we had to do the scramble, Facebook, all that jazz, you know. We went to makeup artists. Like, I don't know if you ever saw Man Bites Dog.
Of course I did. It's an amazing film. Everyone listening, watch Man Bites Dog. It's on Criterion.
They keep killing the sound mixer, you know, on set sound mixer crawling up the reservoir. So that's basically what it was like. We were going through makeup artists like a revolving door, you know. Because again, we didn't really have money, so that's how it goes, right? Nobody really,
of course.
You know, very few people want to, again, and it was in the middle of the winter. But the second day, the second day, which is the second week, it was going to be one of these 18-hour days, and we're shooting in multiple locations. And we were at the beach. We just didn't make it into the film, and none of this footage. And all of a sudden, again, I love my crew and everything.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
But somebody said, "Oh, we don't have, we didn't have anything. We couldn't dump the footage, and we didn't have enough memory cards." Let's just put it that way.
It happens, bro. It happens.
We had like one memory card, you know, and so that was like one of the, that was, you know, I had a full on panic attack. Whatever, we ended up having to drive over and get a laptop and get memory card. It was crazy. I mean, something as simple as that we didn't prepare for, obviously, which is a little ridiculous. But still, we had like, I don't know what it was, like a 64 gigabyte, you know, like whoever was supposed to bring that stuff didn't bring that stuff. So that was one of them. We had another shoot. Also, we were shooting in a lot of places that were given to us as a favor. We weren't paying for it.
Sure.
So one of the places we were shooting at, I just remember being terrified of like things breaking, you know. And of course, we ended up breaking something. And then it was the whole thing was like, who's going to talk to the owner? Who's going to make the call? And we all just were chickens. We were just the whole shooting process was just like fear, because like everybody was just like, let the kids do their thing, let them play a little bit, you know. And then we shot in one place, and this was a horrible shoot, mind you, like horrible. Like everything was disappointing in my head, you know. It was like, we didn't get the scenes right. We didn't get enough coverage. I was like, I was crying inside. You know, we just had all these like really weird, small, disastrous things. And then the craziest thing was we were doing a reshoot of a scene, a murder scene. And this is after the 10 weeks. This is a few weeks later. We finally managed to get everybody available, and we're shooting a scene. And it turns out, we didn't realize, but when we shot there a few weeks before, this location was where a homeless man would sleep. It was his territory. And he remembered us from the first time. And he came, he started like cursing us out. And my line producer is from Colombia, so he speaks Spanish. So he understood what the guy was saying, but he didn't want to like tell us what the guy was saying, because he didn't want to scare us, and we wanted to get our – finally comes over to me. He's like, I think the guy might break the camera. And I said, well, what? And I turn around, and the guy pulls out a knife, and he puts it to my AC's neck. And he's like basically saying, you know, I'm going to kill you if you don't leave. You know, so the first thing I did was grab the camera and run, you know, and the whole crew followed afterwards. I was like,
What happened to the AC?
He was fine, but we just like walked away slowly, like we did, you know. And the guy just chased us out of there. He chased us out of the location. We couldn't go back. We couldn't get any more coverage. And that was it. That's all we had. And I'm afraid to go to that train stop now, because it's near a train station.
Wow, man. Yeah.
Crazy stuff.
It never ceases to amaze me, the stories you hear about productions, especially indie, no budget productions. I've been there. I understand it. I've been there too many times today. I haven't had anyone pull a knife on us. So that's a new one. I haven't had that. But there has been other stories, to say the least. Now I want to ask you a few questions I ask all my guests, man. What advice would you give to that underground filmmaker listening, like you've been listening to me? And what advice would you give them to get their, you know, to get into the business, to do what they love to do?
Yeah. So like you said, like there's no roadmap. Anybody who tells you there's a roadmap, at the end of the day, I think it's bullshit. I remember I got a PA gig actually, like on a big set called The Good Fight, CBS show. My friend Sergio, who was my line producer on my film, he got me in there. That was my thing. Like, I just got to get on a big set, and I have no idea how, right? You don't go on Indeed and get on a big set. It just doesn't work that way. So it turned out that you just have to meet someone who knows someone who could get you on.
Networking. Yeah.
Yeah, which to me is kind of that's really frustrating to me about how the business. It's like this very elitist, high barrier entry type thing. So I finally get on. I'm a stand-in PA. I'm given a radio and stuff, you know. And my job is to stand outside a door. I'm like, there's like 1,000 PAs, and I'm going to stand outside a door and just tell people to be quiet, right? My job basically is to do nothing, but I got paid. It was good money, but like I did nothing the whole day. By breakfast. I was just trying to talk, you know, network, speak to people, find out, like, how do you get into this mysterious place? And I remember I met the production designer of the show, and he was covered in paint, like his pants and everything. And I said, like, how did you get here? How did you? And he looks at me with a big smile. He's like, you're here. And tomorrow, yeah. I was like, oh, thanks. Wow. Great advice. But the point is that there really is. And I remember I asked, you know, how the actors have PAs also, you know, like they're treated like royalty. They can't touch the ground. So I asked the PA to one of the actresses, like, you know, about the director. I'm like, do you know how she got here? Whatever. She's like, you just have to do it. You know? So the point is that even when you're in the you know, the inner chamber,
the machine. Yeah.
Yeah. Like nobody really knows. It's like I remember seeing an interview with David Lynch when he was doing Twin Peaks season 3 in like a cafe. Some woman was interviewing him and she asked David Lynch, you know, what's your advice to a filmmaker, you know, has to make a living or whatever. And he's like, I don't want to talk to such a filmmaker. You know, he was trying to say that if that's your goal, then, you know, because he's a purist, you know, he's a
really he's an artist. Artist. He's a pure artist. Yeah.
Yeah. He's a pure artist. But I think it's true. Even if you do want to make a living off filmmaking, you know, you're going to be in for a lot of heartbreak, probably. Again, I'm in the very beginnings of this. I can't really, you know, give like real sagely advice, but I just think from the little that I've the little path that I've traveled is that make films, try to believe in yourself, and but again, like some people want to. Again, I don't want to impose my thing because I put it this way. I just did my thing. I wanted to make my kind of film. I made the film I wanted to make. So I got lucky. Some people recognized it and they appreciated it. And that was that. But who knows? You know, Ridley Scott has made his first feature at 40 years old. Again, he was a big commercial director. You could point to that. But there are plenty. I mean, David Lynch was like 33, I think, when he did Eraserhead. And so who knows, you know, there is no
there's no path.
ADing. Yeah, there is no path. That's basically the advice, that there is no advice.
Yeah, you know? It is. Yeah, I get asked all the time what that is. It's like, just do what you love to do and try. Just don't bet the house on it, because this is a very difficult path. There's no question. And I've talked to everybody from the biggest guys to like, you know, people just starting out like yourself. And it's always about, you know, how do I get in and what do I do? I'm like, you just got to do it. And you'll meet someone, you'll connect with someone, maybe someone you met now in 6 years, they'll open a door for you that you didn't know about. It happens. It's happened to me. It happens all the time. It's just, that's the thing that's so frustrating about being a filmmaker. It's unlike being a doctor or a lawyer. Those are direct paths to making a career. You know, an engineer, like these are direct paths. Filmmaking is just like, it's like a musician or like arts in general. There is no, there are some paths you could take, but like to be a filmmaker, to be a director, to tell stories like that, it's tough, man. It's tough. But is it doable? I talk to people every day on the show that it worked out. You know, I was able to make a career out of it as well. And still love to do what I love to do. It's just about doing it, man. Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
Oh man, there are too many lessons. Way too many. I think just as a director, what I found, again, like there's no universal, because that's the thing. The arts are so subjective, which is why there's such a diversity of artists and so many different paths in the art world, because it's not a science. It's not a doctor. So, you know, it's not like for a surgeon. Yeah. Like he'll tell you, you know, don't move the knife left because you'll kill the person. But for an artist, it's very different. But for me personally, what I found is that I used to think, I remember I used to be a big Ridley Scott guy.
I still am. I mean, Blade Runner. I mean, Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Blade Runner is, you know,
top five.
Top 10.
No question.
Utter masterpiece. But anyways, I remember him saying, like, you know, how he, you know, I storyboard everything and, you know, like really, you know, he's a tough guy. And yes. Everything is so perfectly premeditated, you know, I remember being terrified watching his interviews. He said, you know, if you're a ninny, then this is not for you. Like all the, you know, and so I used to go into doing the short. He literally says that. And I remember seeing him say that. So I remember I would storyboard everything and just like try to be like very calculated, you know, and like basically not let my actors breathe and not, you know, be this tyrant on set. I'm going to be like Cameron and Scott and all, you know, and again, it works for some, for some people. But what I found, at least for the low budget world, is that oddly, ironically, it helps to sort of like let things go. Like for me, that's what I found. Like that was the biggest that I learned from this feature. But this feature, I came in with all these plans and oh boy, they'd have to throw them away pretty quick, you know?
Gone. So
yeah. I found that like the magic for me happens when it, you know, I'm the cliche of collaboration, but that's kind of what it is. Like, you know, I got lucky. My DP and I, we did two short films after the feature. I got like a really good relationship with him and a really good relationship with my editor and my composer and the main actor in my film. I have a very, almost like a telepathic connection with him, you know, and we're able to sort of vibe off each other. It's kind of like a dance and we just, you know, you have to leave. I think for me, it's leaving room to just allow people to breathe and let's try to, the movie sort of let it take its own form. Let it come alive. It's like this organism that, you know, you only could control to a certain extent, and then you just let it live. And in fact, it ends up making the film better, I think, for me, when I allow the chaos, let the chaos take over. The chaos is good. It's not bad, you know? That's, for me, probably the biggest creative lesson that I learned, you know?
Fair enough. And three of your favorite films of all time?
Oh man, the there are none, but I could come up with three like very important films to me.
Sure.
The 400 Blows, I think, would be one of my favorite films of all time. François Truffaut. I would say Christopher Nolan's Inception.
Mind blowing.
Yeah, I have to say that one. And I would say Fellini's 8.5. Again, this is the mood now, you know, your top three change, you know.
Oh no, that's just the three right now. Yeah, like A Band Plays On by Fellini.
If you would have asked me when I was 10 years old, it would have been Star Wars, you know, so it just changes. But right now, as like a filmmaker, when you're studying the craft, those are the films that really, to me, are like the most important films to me. And Inception, to me, in at least of the modern era of movies, that's like, to me, like the Citizen Kane, what I consider the Citizen Kane for me of modern cinema. Well, so, yeah.
My friend, I appreciate you coming on and being raw and honest about your story. And I wish you nothing but the best. I hope Man does very well and is seen out in the festival circuit. And I hope to have you back when you're doing the next big Marvel movie or something.
Thank you, Alex. Yeah, it's been pretty. Thanks for having me on the show, and I still can't get over that I'm talking to you. It's pretty odd. I'm listening to this voice, you know, the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. You know? I'm talking to you. It's just it's cool and it's an honor, but it's also like, is this real? But okay.
I appreciate you, brother.
Likewise, yeah. Great to meet you, Alex.
I want to thank Saviv so much for coming on the show and sharing his journey with The Drive today. Thank you again so much, Saviv. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/539. And if you haven't already, please head over to filmmakingpodcast.com, subscribe, and leave a good review for the show. It truly helps us out a lot. Thank you again so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast at IndieFilmHustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.